Good afternoon. You're listening to The Buckmaster Show here on 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk, KVOI. I'm Dylan Smith from TucsonSentinel.com. I'm sitting in for Bill, who's on a much-deserved vacation. Joining me here in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio is our senior reporter at the Sentinel, Paul Ingram.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you. And we're going to be speaking today with Jen Fifield, who is a reporter for VoteBeat, a national nonprofit news outlet that really focuses in on elections and voting rights and the whole process of how elections work. Jen is a Arizona reporter, and she's been spending quite a bit of time tracking down all the various threads and permutations of what's going on in our election system. Hi, Jen. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, so glad to be with you today.
Can you give us like a very quick sketch of where we are at? Early voting has started. Like Pima County just sent out nearly 500,000 early ballots, millions more around the state. Kind of what should we be on the lookout for?
Yeah, definitely be checking your mailbox. You should or may have your ballot by now, but definitely by this weekend. And also, you can go vote in person. So there's three locations in Pima County that are open right now. And all of them have ballot drop-offs. So if you get your ballot done, you can drop them by.
And you don't have to necessarily mail it back. You can just turn it in person.
Yep, just sign your envelope, close it up, and drive right up, and you can just drop it in.
And for folks like me who aren't signed up for that early voting list, we can still go get an early ballot and either ask for it through, I believe it's October 25th, right?
To have one sent. Why aren't you on there? What are you doing?
I'm old school. I really like to vote on election day. Somewhere around about like 5:30, 6 p.m. on election day, I like to go, you know, check out what's going on, see what the lines are and everything. Although this time, I think it, you know, we've seen the last couple of elections be, you know, a little bit stressful for reporters. I might get this one done early.
Like, yeah, I mean, I always do mine early just because I end up working the entire day, going and seeing voters and seeing how things are going at all the different polling locations. So having that done is one thing I don't have to worry about.
Yeah, but you don't have
to go. I mean, you know, Dylan, this is going to take like 14 minutes to fill out this very long ballot. That's the estimated time that county recorders and county officials are saying. So I wouldn't want to stand up for that long period, but, you do you.
It is a long ballot this time. Pima County's ballot is actually four pages, two ballot cards front and back with all of the propositions and initiatives and referendums and candidates and judges who are, being facing retention elections. It's long. Why is it so long?
Yeah, you have the 13 propositions, a lot of referrals from state lawmakers, partly because we have a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature. So this is their way of getting ideas before voters. And, you know, they know that they're not going to get the governor to sign off on them. There's a lot, you know, coming up, abortion, all these issues that have been bubbling up that just landed on our ballot.
And those are all, I think, pretty much everywhere on the second ballot card, right? The candidates come first, and then the propositions are on the other one.
Right. So you're going to be tired by the time you get there. You know, I'm wondering how many of those second cards we are going to see, how many people are going to get tired and not do the second card, which it does happen.
Yeah, you know, we see a lot of, you know, undervoting just in a regular election with long ballots. There are still, you know, maybe one card front and back. People that tend to not fill out the entire thing. But some of those issues are, you know, abortion. What is it? Prop 314, which is kind of the SB 1070.
Yeah, I was going to say there's some major propositions. So I actually think some people are really going to go look at those cards. I think it's when it comes to some of the small races, like for constable or some of those. Some of the judges are one I think that people sort of stall out on, and sometimes because they're just not sure what to do. But I think in this particular year, the propositions are actually pretty important. I mean, the abortion one alone, I mean, you had I don't know, 500,000 people signed the petition to get it done, to get it on the ballot. So, I mean, there's a lot of interest and a lot of people fired up about that. So hopefully once they get on that side and start going through the propositions, maybe they'll work their way through the other 12 that they need to get through.
And some of the other things are pretty high profile, too. There's a referendum, well, competing propositions, actually, about changing Arizona's whole election system. Jen, can you kind of run us through the details of those?
Yeah, Proposition 140 is the open primary proposition that would say if you're an independent, if you're not registered with a political party, you can vote in the primary without picking a ballot. You can just go. All of the candidates for all of the parties will be on the same ballot. So you're going to see a list of Republicans and Democrats facing off against one another if you say yes to this proposition. And then the legislature would decide if two of those move forward to the general or if more move forward. And if they decide more would, that would create ranked choice voting, which is a whole nother thing in itself.
Is there a system that's similar like that that's done in other states, or is this new and maybe unique?
Ranked choice voting is used in a few states statewide, and this is a system where, you know, a voter would say, I like this person, you know, that's my first choice, this is my second choice, that's my third choice. They're going to look at all those first choice votes, and then if those don't add up to 50%, they're going to take from the bottom the third person and redistribute those votes. A very controversial system, especially in Arizona, which is why you have the competing proposition, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the number of the proposition in Arizona that would say Republicans have proposed saying we cannot switch to ranked choice voting. We need to use, you know, our general plurality system in Arizona.
Doesn't, I think it's maybe Maine and Alaska have ranked choice voting?
Yeah, I know Alaska does at least, and I think you're right there. And, you know, there's been a lot of controversy about that. There was, I think it was in Alaska where one of the candidates, you know, the more moderate candidate lost. And they said, you know, something wasn't adding up as far as, you know, how it was working out mm-hmm. there. So it's a very complex system and you can do it in many different ways. But I think what voters need to consider for that one is, you know, do you think that there's a problem with the current system? And if your answer is yes, then consider, you know, would we like to go to a system in which, I guess, the party and the party representation matters less, and it's more about selecting the top candidates in your mind?
The first part of the one proposition would create a system pretty much like what California has with what some folks call the jungle primary. And the outcome of that can be where you have two people in the general election ballot facing off against each other who are from the same party. You might end up with two Republicans to choose from in November or two Democrats to choose from in November and not a, you know, a decisive difference between those two candidates.
And wouldn't that be interesting? I don't think that would happen here in Arizona. But, you know, because we have such a split electorate, it might happen in California, right, where there's so many Democrats that, you know, you could end up with two Democrats. In Arizona, I think what would be more likely is we would see that split and to get one Democrat and one Republican on there. There are some concerns from Democrats over this measure, not just Republicans. Democrats say, you know, if you have a candidate who's not as well known, you know, but who's a Democratic candidate, they might not get as much attention on the ballot. Whereas, you know, now if they have the party name behind them and they are the party candidates, then it's a little easier. So, you know, there's downsides, I think, for both parties in this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, think about, like, you know, in Mojave County in a 7-way primary, you would probably have two Republicans come out at the end of that.
Right. In the Pima County, you'd end up with two Democrats.
In Tucson, you know, in a, you know, consider a primary that split 5 ways or 7 ways or however many people run, 13 people could run. You know, who's going to get, who would the top 2 people be?
Yeah, I want to say like in California when they had a governor's race, they had like 50 candidates at one point going through the general primary. So I don't quite know how that works for voters.
That's a heck of a ballot.
Yeah, so to really decide that, it does really, I think it adds a lot of complexity to the system about trying to figure out who's your first choice, but maybe who's your second or third choice and trying to make that work. I don't understand, do we know exactly how the legislature would be involved in this? If this were to go through, what would be their sort of position, or what would their role in doing this?
Yeah, by 2025, I think it's January 1st, 2025, they need to decide how many candidates move on from the primary to the general election. And so they could say, you know, just two, which would be likely if the Republicans have the control over making this decision. They have not supported ranked choice voting, or, you know, it could be a situation where we have three or more candidates, 3 to 5, I think it was, moving forward. And in that case, there would have to be a decision made about how to split the votes. All of those decisions would come in this law that's passed. If they don't pass a law, then it would go to the Secretary of State to decide. And that is kind of the Republicans' main thing against this, is you're giving one person the ability to decide something that is so impactful for our state.
Again, you're listening to the Buckmaster Show here on 1030 The Voice. I'm Dylan Smith of the Tucson Sentinel, sitting in for Bill. If you have a question about some of these election topics, you can call in on the live line. That's 790-2040. The live line is sponsored by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Joining us is VoteBeat reporter Jen Fifield. Jen, tell us a little bit about VoteBeat.
Sure. We're a nonprofit, a national newsroom. We're in 5 states, and we cover national news as well. And our goal is to kind of share the nuanced truth about voting and elections. We do less of the politics and more of the policy discussion about how elections are run. And in the last few years, this, for my job, it has been a lot of, you know, misinformation debunking, looking at claims, looking at real problems in elections, and sorting through how those affect voters.
So in digging into these nuts and bolts, you've been going to a whole lot of courtrooms covering a whole lot of court cases over the past few years.
I mean, yes. I mean, it went right from 2020 into Kerry Lake in 2022. And now, you know, this summer, it's been a lot about Adrian Fontes, our Secretary of State's election procedures manual. He created new rules for this election that Republicans have challenged for 6 months now. And so we're kind of going into the election with some of that sorted out and some of it not. But it has been I've learned a lot about the court system.
The latest wrinkle, there seems to be, what is it now, about 218,000 folks who are registered to vote, fully registered, and seemingly never provided proof of citizenship when they got their driver's licenses. I think I'm probably one of those people. I'm certainly a citizen, but I don't recall ever giving MVD any sort of, you know, document that said I am a citizen. And yet that's what I have used to register to vote. What's going on?
That's probably not good. That's probably the case for a lot of people. So what we're looking at is, did you get your driver's license before 1996?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. And did you register to vote before or after 2004?
I mean, I've updated it, but I've been a registered voter since the 80s, so...
So if you were registered before 2004, you are safe. You do not ever need to provide proof of citizenship to vote. And that's because in 2004, the legislature created the law that says you need to provide proof of citizenship to vote in state and local elections. Anyone before this, though, is grandfathered in. So you're safe. You won't be among the 218,000 people that have to, after the November election, provide proof of citizenship to keep voting a full ballot. But what I would say is, for this election and for November, and this is very important, people do not need to worry about this, because the Supreme Court ruled that because it's so close to the election that we discovered this problem, we're just going to forget it for now until after November.
And there isn't really any indication that there are 200,000 some folks in Arizona who are not citizens who are signed up to vote, right? This is a paperwork problem.
Well, especially especially because these are very long-time residents, and they've lived here for so long, and they attested to their citizenship when they register to vote. You check a box and say, I'm a citizen. There's not a lot of belief, even among the Republican leaders in the state, that we're looking at a lot of non-citizens here, if any. And the problem is this is coming up at such an important time when there's all these claims circulating online about non-citizens voting, which are, you know, there has never been proof that this is a widespread problem. Yes, it happens, but it hasn't ever affected the outcome of an election. We've never seen that in court. And so I think it's just the timing of this that's kind of causing a stir.
Yeah, there was a few years ago, the former Attorney General Mark Brnovich spent a lot of time looking at doing an election integrity unit where they actually investigated lots of claims. And I remember with some of the cases that they released, I mean, they mainly was people who were in prison or had been in prison who had voted and hadn't gotten their rights back. So, I think there was an attempt to look for those kinds of cases, to look for cases of illegal voting by people who were immigrants, who, you know, were in the country legally or illegally. And even Brnovich really couldn't find those cases. It seems like in to a large degree, right, that there's so few cases that, I mean, not only is it rare, but almost like statistically insignificant across not only, you know, local voting, but even national and state voting.
That's right. And you know, you see a few states right now really getting into this idea. I think it was Ohio's Secretary of State that released a list recently, or governor, of thousands of voters that they said were non-citizens. When they started to look, though, at that list, they saw, oh, these are just people who have outdated information on this. You know, these are naturalized citizens. These are people who don't have the correct driver's license on file with us. And so that's the caution here, is that if we start labeling people as non-citizens right before an election, when they really are, that is definitely disenfranchising a good portion of voters.
Yeah, and remember the original list that Fontes put out? Wasn't it significantly the most biggest chunk was actually Republicans who were included in the first list?
Yes. Yeah, it was definitely the majority were Republicans, and that's just because of the political makeup of our state before 1996 when this is affecting these voters.
We need to take a quick break here to hear from some of the fine Buckmaster Show sponsors. One of those, of course, sponsors this portion of the show. That's Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the famous Danish Kringle. Mona's is located on the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. They're open Tuesday through Sunday for breakfast and lunch. You should treat yourself to their mouthwatering pastries, including that Kringle. Mona'sDanishBakery.com. And we will be right back.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
On average, the Regional Transportation Authority annually contributes over $100 million to regional transportation improvements to supplement limited federal and state funds. This critical funding source provides funding for nearly two-thirds of our region's needed transportation improvements through its 2006 voter-approved half-cent sales tax. To receive updates on a new 20-year plan in development, visit rtanext.com.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com. Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show here on 1030 The Voice, KVOI, trusted local news and talk. I'm Dylan Smith at the Tucson Sentinel. I'm sitting in for Bill. Joining me here in the studio, the Green Things Zocalo Village studio, is Paul Ingram, the senior reporter for the Sentinel. And on the line is Jen Fifield of VoteBeat. That live line is sponsored by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. And Jen is a reporter who has spent the last several years really digging into exclusively the nuts and bolts of how Arizona's elections work. Thank you very much, Jen, for taking some time with us today.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So we are, what, 3 weeks out from election day? And sort of still litigating the last election, if not the election before that. These things seem to take a long time to play out. Why?
Yeah, it doesn't feel like we've had a lack of election since 2020. It feels like, you know, my editor said something the other day, like, when this election is over, and I reminded him that it's unlikely to be over. And that's just because we have people that refuse to, you know, acknowledge their loss, that challenge their loss. And we actually saw this in the primary in Pinal County, where a candidate, you know, disagreed with his loss and said it was fraud. And they just got done with a $150,000 audit on the primary election, which is, if you told me that 5 years ago, that would have surprised me a lot that they would spend taxpayer money on something like that. But we're seeing such voter distrust because of all these challenges, and it may just continue this year. We'll see, depending on who wins.
And that the case you just mentioned was a current Pinal County supervisor who was trying to run for sheriff, correct?
Correct. Yeah, this was Supervisor Kevin Kavanaugh, and he's had kind of some of these investigations in the past that have cost the county money. And, you know, he disagreed that he lost his sheriff race 2-1. They commissioned this audit, took weeks on it, hired three experts, brought in an outside law firm. It cost $150,000. They looked at the voting machines. They looked at, you know, the security of the center, everything. And they just found absolutely nothing, which, You know, it was good on the part of the county, right, to look into this because they have had such problems in Pinal County with their elections. But was it worth it for taxpayers is what you have to ask yourself. And should we be, you know, asking the candidate to pay for this if they want certain audit after the election, too?
And aren't there things that elections officials do beforehand, before the election, to even set? I mean, it seems like they actually test equipment. They do a lot of things to make sure things are working. And then when somebody loses, then they have to do another $150,000 audit, right? What do elections officials do before an election to actually guarantee that the vote machines and things are working?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I think this is coming to more public attention, but there is a lot done beforehand, and counties across the state just got done with something called the logic and accuracy test, which takes a ballot, puts it through the machines that they will use to tabulate the ballots, and looks at how it's calculating the results and how it's evaluating the marks on the paper. It's looking at things like undervotes and overvotes and how the machine is dealing with all these problems that come up in a normal election. And if it's dealing with write-ins accurately, And these audits always come back, you know, they always ensure that they're coming back 100% accurate before they're certifying the machine. The Secretary of State's audit office is involved. They're also doing, you know, stuff like mass testing of printers. You know, that didn't go so well in Maricopa County. Hopefully it's better this time. But, you know, they try to catch as many problems as they can. And one thing this year that people have been testing on is our new two-card, four-page ballot. So two pages front and back. And they did a lot of testing to try to prevent errors. We could see some errors, people voting in person, especially with how those ballots are being tabulated. Let's just hope it's not on a wide-scale manner. But yes, there's so much done beforehand to try to make sure, you know, they don't want mistakes, right? They, you know, that they realize what that does to public confidence.
You mentioned some of the problems that were took place in Pinal County in the last state and federal election cycle. There was so much attention paid to Maricopa County, where, you know, there were some hiccups, but it's been demonstrated that everybody's vote was counted in Maricopa County. The initial returns coming out of Pinal left out a bunch of ballots, didn't they?
They did. And during the general election, there was a miscount of ballots due to mostly to misorganization and improper tracking of ballots by poll workers that they've tried to solve at this point. Those are hard things to solve. And they built an entire new election center. It's like state of the art, got all this crazy security. And all of this room, and that was their problem. As our Arizona grows and our populations grow, some of our election centers are just kind of getting overblown with ballots and equipment and everything. That includes Maricopa. I'm sure that's the case in Pinal, I mean, in Starring Pima. And so, you know, they were looking at a case of just being so compacted. And the other thing is we just have a lack of knowledge of long-term staff on election staff across the state. And that came into play in Pinal with a new elections director last cycle. And so, you know, it's seeing that new officials across the state are getting support too.
Isn't that something that's gotten a little bit worse over the past couple of years? There's some brain drain going or taking place as elections officials quit. A number of them saying they are, you know, feeling far too threatened, them and their families, and they just can't deal with it anymore.
Yeah, I was actually looking at the numbers last night as I work on a kind of related story, but to preview that eventual story, when we went into the 2016 cycle, we only had four recorders who had been there less than one cycle. And at this point, we have eight as of now that have been there for, they have never conducted a presidential election before.
Eight out of the 15 across the state.
Yes, yes. If you look at election directors, it's even more extreme. And these are people that have been under such stress and such harassment since 2020 that a lot of them have just said, you know, this isn't for me, or, you know, they're near retirement and they said, well, you know, I could always retire. So we're dealing with a lot of new people going into this presidential election.
Can you kind of tell quickly for listeners what the difference is between the elections director and the difference between the recorder? I mean, what are those two roles are and how does that work?
Well, the recorders are busy right now because they do voter registration and early voting. And so even early in-person voting, managing the voter rolls, making sure people are properly registered to vote, that's all the recorder side. And this kind of varies across the state, but typically that's what it is. The elections directors are usually managed by the county supervisors. And these are folks that are not elected positions. The recorder is. And typically come with some kind of county administrative experience, or they've been an election director elsewhere. They've worked in elections, and they really run the ship for election day. They make sure that the polling places, we have enough, we have, you know, a proper distribution of ballots, we have all the technology ready.
Jen, we have just a couple more minutes with you, but you just mentioned polling places, and can you run down the difference between the, you know, old, kind of old school precinct polling places and the new vote centers, which are we now have in Pima County? Maricopa County has them. I think most counties in Arizona do now, right?
Most counties do. I just learned this yesterday. Only two counties are still in the precinct model that has historically been what we used before 2016 about, where, you know, you have to go in your neighborhood to vote. You're assigned a polling place. If you go somewhere else, your ballot doesn't count. Now you can go in most counties, including Pima County, you can go to any location, go up on recorder.pima.gov. You find a location near your work or anywhere you are, and you can go vote your own ballot. And that's because of the technology that's used at what we call vote centers, where you're able to check in on a live electronic pad. They have your updated voter information, and they print you your correct ballot for your precinct.
So it's printed
kind of like a live on-demand system.
Yeah, while you're standing there, they print a ballot that is appropriate for the place that you are registered to vote at. Even if you're, you know, physically standing on the other side of town, they can get you the correct ballot.
Right, and it's really convenient, but there's been some complaints as we switched because it has eliminated some of the polling sites. So make sure to check you're going to the right place because, you know, if you can vote anywhere, there's less lines, and so there's not as much need for a polling place in every single neighborhood. And so you're going to see a reduced number compared to 2020 when you went to vote in Pima County, because the county has made a switch since then. If you voted in the 2022 election, you know the drill, but some people haven't.
Okay. Jen Fifield from VoteBeat, thank you so very much for joining us here on the Buckmaster Show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Coming up in just a couple of minutes, we will be back and run down some more local news with Paul Ingram of the Tucson Sentinel, and we will be right back.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
Are you ready to immerse yourself in a diverse culture while wandering through bustling markets, sampling exotic cuisines, or forging connections with people from all walks of life? Well, Bon Voyage Travel is here to plan your perfect journey. Whether you're setting off on a solo expedition, embarking on a group adventure, or simply dreaming of far-off destinations, we can help create your custom experience. The road ahead is filled with endless possibilities. Visit bvtravel.com to find your specialized Bon Voyage Travel advisor today.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org. For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
the extraordinary beauty and craftsmanship of Mexican artisans is yours at Clay and Cloth in Barrio Viejo, featuring gorgeous clay pottery sourced from southern Mexico, including Oaxaca, Puebla, Merida, and Hidalgo. Also discover amazing textiles you won't find anywhere else in Tucson. Clay and Cloth also has an incredible selection of new Dia de los Muertos merchandise. See the selection on Instagram at Mad Max the Dog Shop and visit Clay and Cloth. Open Tuesday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at 310 South Convent, just south of Cushing.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show, broadcasting from the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. I'm Dylan Smith of the Tucson Sentinel, sitting in for the vacationing Bill Buckmaster. Joining me here in the studio is Paul Ingram, a senior reporter for the Sentinel. Paul, you make a lot of trips down to the border.
Right. Especially this last couple of weeks.
Yeah. You made a specific one down to Nogales yesterday. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I went down to see CBP commissioner. Well, I guess he's not the actual commissioner, but he's the acting commissioner.
They have a very long title for
yeah,
this guy.
Yeah. Senior official performing the duties of... it's because the previous commissioner was Chris Magnus, our former yes. police chief, was 86th by the Biden administration. And since then, Troy Miller has been in the position. Troy has...
We can call him the commissioner, though, pretty much, right?
Yeah, sure. I just say he's the chief. He's the head of of a CBP, and we can move on. So he came down, and it's important to know that the fiscal year just ended in September.
The federal fiscal year,
and so that's all the data that comes from the federal agencies, including Customs and Border Protection. And Customs and Border Protection, just to be very quick, is the agency that's in charge of the ports. It's also the agency that's in charge of Border Patrol, and also the helicopters that you occasionally see flying over Tucson and then out towards the border.
So they run the border crossings as well as in between the border crossings.
You got it. And so Miller came out and he wanted to talk about the statistics at the end of the year about things that they did. And there's really two main focuses. The first, of course, is immigration. How many people have crossed the border illegally? They were taken into custody by Border Patrol agents and then they were released or they were removed from the United States and sent back to Mexico or their countries of origin. The other focus, of course, was fentanyl. That's really been the sort of central issue for the last couple of years, especially for seizures. Of course, you know, Customs Border Protection intercepts lots of different kinds of drugs, but fentanyl is the one they put a lot of focus on. And earlier this year, back in April, Miller went to the Customs House in Nogales, and he talked about this Operation Plaza Spike, which is really a program that's focused on the cartel bosses, the plaza bosses, who are in charge of moving fentanyl. And so in the last several months, they've really focused on going after the people who make fentanyl, who move fentanyl, and then also smuggle fentanyl into the United States. That has actually given them some pretty good results. They've caught a lot of doses. They've caught more than a billion doses worth of fentanyl. And they've also, which means millions and millions of pills. And they've really tried to intercept it. Not only have they tried to just intercept the drugs, but they've tried to break down the networks. They've gone after the cash. They've gone after also the precursor chemicals. One thing that I thought was really interesting, which I really hadn't heard before, was Miller talking about these forward operating chemists who actually go, they look at the drugs, and then they try to figure out where those drugs are coming from, who's making it, where they're getting their chemistry from, and really trying to break down those networks as well. So it's kind of an all hands on deck situation for CBP to really figure out how to deal with fentanyl. So, and so Miller wanted to talk about those issues, and I also wanted to talk about the numbers, and he wanted to show that they're being successful, that they're clamping down on fentanyl, and also that they've been really successful when it comes to mitigating the number of people who are crossing the border.
From the stats that the federal government puts out, at least of the, you know, drug smugglers that they do intercept and catch, seems like most fentanyl is smuggled by people who are U.S. citizens and doing it through, you know, the legal, regular border crossings, you know, stuffed in a car somewhere, right?
That's exactly right. The one thing to keep in mind about fentanyl is that it's small. It's lots of tiny, tiny little pills. There's also sort of sometimes people have done liquid fentanyl, so it's a kind of a liquid in a bucket, and they'll try to sneak that in lots of different ways. They're making kind of custom structures inside of cars, hiding them inside of doors, hiding them inside of tires, hiding them into cargo vehicles, and the agency has really done it. And one thing to keep in mind is that most smuggling is done by U.S. citizens, especially fentanyl. U.S. citizens are one who are driving across, who have the drugs in their vehicles, and so those are all leading to prosecutions. So you see really that the part of it is that the drug smuggling has changed. You know, 10 years ago, you were seeing marijuana smuggling. You were seeing like semi-tractor trailers just full of marijuana, sometimes, you know, decorated to make look like watermelons or or stashed into like airplane parts and stuff. They're not doing that anymore. They have shifted towards stuffing cars full as much fentanyl as they possibly can. Part of it is because fentanyl is really, really easy to make. It's not a crop. So you don't have like a seasonal thing. You don't have to have land to it. You just have to have the right chemistry and you can just make as many pills as you possibly can
weed
get
away
with.
Weed is pretty bulky and plus totally. Basically legal so many places in the country. Like, you know, it's no longer a huge, you know, focus for drug smuggling, right?
Right. And you see like, you see cocaine smuggling and heroin smuggling being
a little bit of meth.
And methamphetamine being a little bit, being pretty stable. Fentanyl, the one is that really came from not something that CBP even tracked, all of a sudden a huge issue. And that happened over 5 years. It started during the Trump administration. It's carried through the Biden administration. So, you know, the agency is really focused on that and trying to figure that out, which means that they've tried to deploy new technology. They've tried to deploy new science. They've tried to think about analytics, trying to figure out how to figure out who's got drugs in their car and then start making arrests.
And you mentioned also Miller touting some success in migration numbers, you know, basically catching folks who are coming across, right?
Well, and now we see right now migration has dropped. It's 55% lower than it was in June, and that's down from a high in December. You know, in December, the agency caught 250,000 people. It's worth keeping in mind that this includes people who cross illegally and tried to run from agents. They dress in camouflage. They get into vehicles, which then race through parts of like Cochise County, try to get, you know, avoid them. It also includes families, you know, all these people who are asylum seekers who have crossed the border and are actually looking for agents. So those are included in encounters, because for an agent, once you take somebody into custody, that's what matters, and how that, you know, how that person arrived or what that person did in that moment is not counted in the same, and not counted differently. It's counted the same way. And those really represent really different people. You know, back in November, we were out in the desert outside of Lukeville, and there was 750 people. I talked to hundreds of them. You know, a lot of them were families. They were standing in line and they were waiting for agents to take them into custody and take them up to the station. That's really, really different than people who are hiding in camp, who are in camouflage, who are running from agents. So, you know, but in December, either way, 250,000 people. The Tucson sector alone had 85,000 people. And now we're seeing in August, which is the most recent numbers that they've released, because they're still counting, still adding up September, but they had about 55,000 across the entire border. So we see how much things have changed.
And the Biden administration has instituted some new policies this year about how they handle asylum seekers when they show up.
Exactly. They've changed the process. Back in June, they announced they did a presidential proclamation which changed the rules. Simply put, they raised the level of asylum of what you have to say to agents. You require
the magic words.
The magic words. They also require people to say the magic words to an agent. And then if they do, then they get a 4 hours to sort of prepare themselves. They have a chance to talk to a lawyer. And then they kind of go through a very, very high-speed hearing, which decides. The people who fail end up with a 5-year bar, which means they can ask for asylum, they can enter the United States for the next 5 years, unless if they do, they'll face some kind of prosecution. That was solidified just a week ago, and is now is going to be part of U.S. law. There's the federal structure, they get to announce that they're going to do a law, and then the people get 30 days to respond. We're going through that process right now. So you know, before the election, we'll be in the situation where this is a permanent part of how the immigration law system works with regard to asylum seekers. And that is part of the thing I think that's driving down, that most people think is driving down the number of people who are crossing. You know, I talked to the Tucson sector chief of Border Patrol, and he said, you know, they're expecting, it wasn't just a dip, but that's the dip that seems more permanent because of this.
And then part of that, if there are too many people who are not coming across through the ports of entry, through the official border crossing points, that they will just put a temporary halt on processing any asylum seekers?
That's a great point. And that's going to change too. Originally, back in June, it's 2,500 people. And this is, keep in mind, across the entire U.S. border. And it's an average. So now it's going to go down to 1,500. The one thing too is that they included unaccompanied minors previously that hadn't come in. And what do we mean when we say an unaccompanied minor? That's a kid who is not 18, who's, you know, under 18, who's traveling without a parent or guardian. So that includes, you know, sometimes you'll see, I've met, you know, kids who are, say, a kid who's 16 and who kids brought his 10-year-old brother. Both of those kids are unaccompanied minors. So they're going to be included in number two. So that's going to change. That changes the threshold. So and keep in mind, so in with all those changes, it really means that a lot of asylum seekers are going to stay in Mexico. They're going to have to wait for their case. Now, the other thing too is we haven't really talked about is CBP One, which is an app that lets people sort of apply for an appointment, for a chance to go into the port. And once they get those appointments, then they get to go through and actually seek asylum, but they still have to go through the asylum process. So it still takes time for them to do that. Some people have been waiting more than 6 months. So, you know, and in each, you know, as things move on, we're going to see probably more changes through the asylum system. It's a fairly complicated system. There's several laws that really guide how this does. There's one called the Convention Against Torture, and that really requires the United States to accept people who really fear returning. And so what a lot of people who work with migrants have said is that there's this change has put migrants in the position where they may be sent back to a place where they could be prosecuted or even murdered by people who are, you know, after them. So, you know, the question is really, how does that work in the long term, you know, especially against people, especially as it goes through with, you know, how it gets done, is how's it get done over time with the number of people who are crossing. Since with the threshold changing, we have to see whether or not CBP will ever lower that threshold and start really accepting people with the asylum like they used to, or whether that just kind of ends up in a permanent structure.
So all these border issues have been pretty prominent in this political campaign, which makes Arizona kind of a focus. You know, we're a swing state, of course, but also being right on the border. We've had a whole ton of politicians show it up lately, haven't we?
Oh, it's pretty incredible. A friend of mine said, you know, the other day that Tucson has become the belle of the ball, or Arizona, I guess, has become the belle of the ball. But it starts to really feel like it's also Tucson. I think we're used to people traveling to Arizona, going to someplace in Phoenix and doing a rally there, but not really coming to Southern Arizona. And that has really changed this election. Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, went out to Cochise County and stumped for themselves out a chunk of the border wall. But then, you know, Kamala Harris went out to Douglas and she did her own speech a few weeks later. And then we also got to see, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, who came here Thursday, along with J.D. Vance, who returned to Southern Arizona and also stumped yesterday. So, I mean, it was back-to-back vice presidential candidates.
We had one day a couple weeks ago with Donald Trump speaking here in Tucson. Right, and right. Doug Emhoff, the I guess they call him the second gentleman, the husband of Kamala Harris,
right,
and also a cabinet official, and a whole lot of administration officials keep coming. Somebody else who's pretty prominent is coming apparently next Friday.
Yeah, we're hearing, we've been told that President Barack Obama is coming. He's going to be here in Tucson next Friday.
With no details yet about where or when.
Yeah, we don't know where or when. He's going to have some guests. I don't know who those are either, but as soon as we know, we'll tell you.
All right. that'll be coming up basically next weekend. We'll hear a little bit about what we can do around town this weekend right after this break. We got to hear from some more of these amazing Buckmaster Show sponsors. We will be right back.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. In 2006, Pima County voters approved the Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year Regional Transportation Plan and half-cent sales tax. They are both effective through June 30th, 2026. For the region to receive continued funding for another 20 years, the RTA is developing a new plan and tax extension for voter consideration. Public input will be key. To receive updates on a new 20-year plan in development, visit rtanext.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The News and Sun's media reach 75% of the region through newspapers, websites, social media, video, newsletters, and more. They also produce more than a dozen print and digital magazines annually for an audience of 70,000. Find them at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, covering your hometown.
Cushman & Wakefield Picor is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield Picor offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at picor.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's picor.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show here on 1030 The Voice, KVOI. I'm Dylan Smith from Tucson Sentinel, sitting in for the vacationing Bill Buckmaster. And of course, it's time for Weekend Watch with 101.7 The Drive, presented by Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico. You can enjoy the best of the Land of Enchantment in Silver City. It's only about a three-hour drive from Tucson. Once you're there, you can hike in the Gila National Forest, visit the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument. Start your planning for your New Mexico getaway by visiting southwestnewmexico.org. And now, with some great ideas for what to do on a hot weekend here in Tucson, is Ken Carr from our sister station, 101.7 The Drive. What's going on, Ken? And why is it so hot, man?
Well, I don't know. Global warming? We could probably do hours of content on that, right? You know, one of the things that happens when we have an ultra warm stretch is you try to find things to do indoors.
Yeah.
One of the really cool things this weekend is Film Fest Tucson. And this is kind of a homegrown film festival, but you've got a few different venues. A couple are outside. But the one that the movie that really sticks out in this festival to me is a movie that's actually showing tonight at the Fox at 8 o'clock. It's called Space Cowboy. And it features footage from Skydive Arizona in Eloy. You aware of this joint in Eloy?
Absolutely.
It's amazing. It's actually one of the more active and bigger skydive businesses in the country. And they have footage like people sitting in a car and it getting pushed out of and parachuting.
So you're saying if you really want to get your vertigo going, you should sit up in the balcony of the Fox and watch this movie?
Absolutely. Hopefully nobody will be diving off of that would be a news story, wouldn't it? Let's see, what else is going on this weekend? Another thing is, if you're feeling a little classy, there's Zen Blues and Barbecue. That's at Hacienda del Sol Guest Ranch, and it's wine tasting, not out of a box, but the actual bottles.
The actual bottle of wine. Yeah, right on.
You get the whole bottle?
Well, if you really want it, sure. You thirsty? Barbecue menu, live music from local blues artists, and you do have to be 21 or older to go to that. Oktoberfest. This is the last weekend for this in Mount Lemmon. So if you're tired of the heat, this is a really great event to go to. Head up the hill.
Get away from that a little bit.
You were just saying
during that break off the air, how many days of 100 degree heat have we had?
We hit the record yesterday at 109, 100 plus degree days.
And we may be hitting that again right now, right?
We're going to be very close. The forecast high is 99. It's likely we'll probably hit 100.
Wow.
I know.
So time to drive up the hill and
get some German beer.
And maybe make careful arrangements about getting back down the hill, right?
Well, gravity will help.
Is that the theme for the day?
That's a little bad news.
You get a designated driver if you're going to have much of the beer, but there's also German food, live music, and then dancing, kids'
Poke
games.
Poke your heart out.
Absolutely. And one other thing about this time of year, you start thinking about Halloween, right? So we have, I call this the Big Four. And this is the four what I consider most significant events for Halloween. There's lots of events to choose from, but you have Nightfall at Old Tucson. You have the Slaughterhouse. You have Terror in the Corn and Marana Pumpkin Patch. So three of the four of these are really scary, and one is like super fluffy, family friendly. Nightfall is at Old Tucson, and they have, you know, new, not I don't know, you call it ownership, but a new group that's running Old Tucson
management.
Now. So there's new blood in there. There's lots of new things to see.
Excellent.
Lots of new things to scream at.
Thank you very much, Ken Carr. We got to tell you folks that the Buckmaster Show is produced by Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC, which is solely, wholly, totally responsible for its content. I have nothing, no responsibility whatsoever for this. It's all on Bill. I'm Dylan Smith of the Tucson Sentinel sitting in for him while he's on vacation. On behalf of longtime Buckmaster Executive Assistant Rosemary Brandt and the entire team here at Bustos Media, including the man behind the glass there, Tom Fairbanks, have a wonderful and very safe weekend, folks.